The Tom Woods Show, episode 659.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, one of the first things you figure out when you become a libertarian is that all the U.S. presidents your teachers told you were great were terrible. Learn the true history of the U.S. presidents and their crimes against liberty in our new course on the presidents. Check it out at freehistorycourse.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Yes, I did miss an episode yesterday. It's the first time in probably at least a year that it was a weekday and I didn't produce an episode, but doggone it, it was a lot of pulling my hair out and just a lot of time-consuming work recovering from the horrifying technical ordeal we had that I've been telling you about regarding the feed. And of course, if you're on my email list, you know all about the details of that. So I think we finally got things back up and running. There's still a couple of things on the website itself that somehow, I think because of a recent WordPress update, somehow got screwed up. So the podcast player on the site, in order for it to work right now, you have to click the pop-out button, and then when it pops out, you can press play and listen. But we have a little bit more work to do. I got to find the people who coded the site initially and get them to fix whatever went wrong when WordPress was updated. Anyway, just totally crazy, and I just needed a mental health day. And I thought, you know, I have done all those bonus episodes. You know, like that McCaffrey one was worth like three episodes. So I'm not going to rebuke myself too much, and I appreciate everybody's patience. So we're coming back with a bang today, however. And by the way, we got some great episodes coming up next week. I got Doug Casey coming back on the show. If you know who he is just always great to talk to. I wish I could talk to him every week. Norman Horn's coming back. It's going to be really good. But today it's Michael Malice. Michael has a column on Trump, but really it's more on the U.S. presidency in general. And there seems to be a bit of a problem where some people, their critique of Trump is just that he's a buffoon or he's too crude or whatever. And this just so totally misses the point, if you ask me. I mean, if they're coming to, you know, if we're going to bomb people, I don't care if the person bombing them is crude or sophisticated. That's sort of beside the point. Or the people who take my taxes, I don't care if they take them and they curse at me or they recite a Shakespearean sonnet. It's totally beside the point. I want my money. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. You know Michael Malice. He's a celebrity ghostwriter. He is a frequent guest on Fox Business, where you can see him regularly on Kennedy and also on Fox News. Michael can be visited at michaelmalice.com. He is, of course, also the author of Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. I will be linking to that and to Michael's site and Twitter. Lots of fun stuff at tomwoods.com/659, where, of course, I will also link to his column. Michael Malice, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom Woods.
It has been four freaking months since I've had you on the show. That's just horrifying, and that can never happen again.
Get it together, Tom, like Donald Trump said.
That's right. Yesterday, I didn't even do an episode. I just had so much fallout from this horrifying problem with the podcast feed. So if I'm not going to do an episode, then the one that follows the missed one had darn well better be, you know, we better turn that up to 11. So I thought, Michael Malice, absolutely. So you have a column in The Observer, and well, in fact, you have a column in The Observer, a regular column in The Observer at observer.com.
Yeah.
And I'm going to link to the column, of course, as I always do, on the show notes page. And this column, now, do you come up with the headlines, or do they sometimes override your headlines, or who's responsible for the title of the piece?
So they come up with the headlines. The last one I did, I just had a piece about Phyllis Schlafly. Now that I understand their syntax, this is a biweekly column. I'm trying to, you know, fit into their kind of style, but the first two columns was their choice.
Okay, but this title's not bad. It does kind of sum up what you're trying to say in the column. So it's called "It's Not President Trump That Scares Me; It's Presidents." Period.
Yeah,
that's so great. That actually is a great sentiment. That's really great. All right, so let's unpack this a little bit. Everybody's saying that it would be terrifying to have Donald Trump as president. I got Max Boot saying he would rather vote for Stalin. Can you imagine that? I mean, I think he really needs to be taken to task for minimizing the crimes of Stalin by saying that. So he would, but something tells me that it's okay to say that you'd vote for Stalin. It's a weird society.
Well, hey, most of those National Review types were ex-Stalinists, so this is perfectly fitting.
It's totally natural for them, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's organic.
Yeah, so you would rather vote for Stalin than for Trump. All right. And we're getting people who say they're going to move out of the country if he gets elected. These are all people I would love to see leave, so, you know, don't tempt me. You know, so it's just one crazy thing after another. Now, you know, the guy drives me up a wall, too. You know, he says one thing, and then he thinks that the Fed is blowing up a bubble, and then on the other hand, he says, "But I like the low interest rate policy." Okay, but that's the thing, you know, that's kind of the thing.
Right.
So there are a lot of these that drive me crazy. But the point is, if I were to look through a lot of other presidential candidates, you know, I'd find a whole lot. They don't know anything about the Fed. Come on. Like, most of them don't know anything about the Fed. So in your piece, you say it's a cliche that a Trump presidency is a terrifying prospect. But then in the very end of just that first paragraph, you say it's the presidency itself that is a terrifying reality. How can you say something so extreme?
Yeah, we don't have room for extremism on this show.
Oh, not on this show. Aren't you throwing out the baby with the bathwater?
Yeah, President Baby. That sounds like a terrible NBC show. No, first of all, you do know that Trump has said that he would audit the Fed by executive order within the first 100 days of his presidency. Did you hear that?
I did not hear that.
Yes. So he has on record, who knows if that means anything, but he has said explicitly he will issue an executive order to have the Fed audited within the first 100 days of his presidency. That's number one. Number two is you were one of the people who pointed this out to me, that one of the big problems we have is that people look up to the presidency and it kind of is this Hamiltonian aristocracy. And that allows these people to get away with literal murder and all sorts of other heinous acts. And if Trump were the president, you know, I make the point in this article, Trump wouldn't be able to get away with half the things that Obama gets away with, because Obama's a great guy. He's a nice guy. He looks good on TV. He listens to the music that you listen to, you being the median voter. And Trump is a crazy person foaming at the mouth. So he would not have the social room to do half the things that Obama or even Hillary can.
Yeah, but you wonder, though, given some of his bluster and his, you know, I'm in charge kind of personality, would he even care? Wouldn't you just say, look, I'm the president. I'll do whatever the heck I want. I'm the president.
Well, I mean, I think that's the policy now. And I think that was the policy, you know, in the Bush years. I wrote this article for The Guardian a couple of years ago about why I don't vote. Ever. And the point I made is that democracy and the law is really an ex post facto rationalization for politicians to do what they intend to do anyway. So we remember in the aughts during the Bush years, he went to the UN for authorization for Iraq. He was for the Iraq war. He was denied it. And he didn't say, well, we didn't get authorization, we're going home. He's like, well, here's this other back-end loophole we're going to use to further our goal. Same thing with the Democrats and Obamacare. They just used the I forgot what it's called, that reconciliation package, which was meant for budgeting, to push through Obamacare when Scott Brown's election lost them Congress. So this idea that the Constitution is going to bind people and that politicians are willfully going to, you know, tie their hands is a fallacy. And Trump, I agree with you, will be just like Obama and everybody else, meaning he'll have his executive order. Like, even the New York Times was saying that half of those executive orders that Obama was passing were grossly unconstitutional, and they were looking around at each other being like, should we do something about this? And they didn't know what to do because, again, he's one of their own. So this is something that's problematic, and I hate using that word, for any president, and would not be, you know, unique to President Trump.
Well, how about that point about it's fair game to kill the families of terrorists? Surely that's exclusive to Trump?
Well, no. As you know, this is the policy now. There was an article written, I forget what paper it was, some British paper, by someone who's on the government's terrorist watch list. Now, when you get on the watch list, just like on the do not fly list, they don't tell you that you're on and they don't tell you why you're on, right? So what was happening is this guy had to stop. And let's suppose this guy's a terrorist and deserves to be killed. I'm going to give him the benefit of the opposite of the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to say this guy really deserves to be killed, right? But the thing is, he's going to like his cousin's weddings and he's going to like schools, and the missiles are hitting the schools and meal at places where he's eating meals and innocent people are being killed. So now he can't associate with anyone, which I guess is the point. But the consequence is this is already the policy that's under being like put into place by the Obama administration. And no one on the left seems to have a problem with it when it's done with a smile and it's done implicitly. When Trump goes on TV and says, we're going to do that. Yes, it's terrible. But the point is, what I don't understand why anyone is saying it's terrible that he's going to do this. Isn't it much worse that this is currently being done?
And I mean, I like this. Let me read a little passage, because the last sentence of this really, really sums up the weird – again, I call it Trump derangement syndrome. They can only see problems with Trump. I see problems with Trump, but I have apparently a big enough brain to see problems with a lot of these people.
Oh, yes.
So you write, our drones and our armed forces kill, and the apologies are never forthcoming. That's a reference to Mitt Romney's book. We live in a time where the U.S. Air Force bombing of a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan causes as much furor as President Obama's decision to wear a tan suit. True, President Obama is not perceived as erratic. He does not make glib comments about his opponents. When he executes, he does so with a steady hand. So, you know, in other words, okay, it's true he doesn't call people names, and it's true he's not uncouth about it when he goes and kills people, but is that really sort of the moral point here that we should get so worked up about? Well, Trump will be worse because look at what his crazy behavior. Okay, so now we've got a calm murderer. We've got a really steady, even-handed murderer. That's a lot better. What is wrong with you people?
And it's interesting because everyone likes to compare Trump and Cruz to like these historical figures. So Trump, as we all know, is both literally Hitler and the Antichrist, and also somehow Mussolini in that mix. But if you want to, you know, play that game, we can compare Obama to Robespierre, who was one of the, you know, big architects of the French Revolution. And Robespierre was known as the incorruptible. You know, he was a virgin all his life. He was a true believer. And he very calmly sent people to the guillotine because he thought this is the right thing to do. He had this sense of moral authority, and he surely felt no guilt about executing, you know, so-called class enemies. And that's the whole thing with politicians. There's this sense of, I think there has to be psychologically, frankly, a sense of self-righteousness, because if you have the gall to, you know, execute people and knowing innocent people are going to be killed as a result of your actions and to be fine with that, that takes a certain psychological step that I think is very, very dangerous and frankly, a little bit foreign to my thinking, and I'm sure yours. And people don't realize that they don't think the way that we do. I mean, it would be very hard for me to be like, you know, make that phone call and go out to this place and, you know, just bomb this hospital.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. I think it would be for, you know, for all the sorts of people who never consider running for office and who never would be part of the machine. That is true.
Right.
Now there is one point that you make that might have been slightly eclipsed by events, and that is the point about Republican candidates just carelessly, thoughtlessly advocating shooting down Russian planes.
Yeah.
Because I saw an article where apparently Trump has said, well, under some circumstances, you know, yeah, you might have to do that. So unfortunately, it blurs the point a bit. But your point is that at least, you know, up till quite recently, we would be hearing these candidates, even Kasich, who's supposed to be the moderate, reasonable one, would be talking about this. Sure, of course, we got to shoot down Russian planes. And people just accepted that as, well, you know, that's their policy and whatever. Well, then Trump would say, you know, I think I could sit down with Vladimir Putin and we could work something out. Then he was insane, but it was not insane. It might be misguided or unwise, maybe, but certainly not insane to advocate shooting down planes of one of the strongest militaries on Earth. Again, that's weird to me. That's Trump derangement syndrome again.
And we all remember when we were kids and when we're all growing up, we're in school and we always ask the teacher, like, why is there war? Because, you know, it seems so obvious to most children that war is just this insane situation. And basically, you know, the thing we were always taught in school is that, look, it's a last resort. And, you know, there's bad people out there, and sometimes these bad people won't listen to reason. And the only thing you can do is kind of beat them up and shut them up, right? Or otherwise, a lot of innocent people are going to be killed. And that's a plausible, you know, framework. I can accept that. But the idea that, like, oh, if Putin insults me, I'm going to start World War III. You know, no. This bluster and this chip on their shoulder, you know, for all, it's really just because these guys are in suits and saying these things calmly. If you unpack it, it's really kind of creepy. There's not every country in the world is going to like us. Not every country in the world is going to respect us. And the idea that, like, if you disrespect me, I'm going to go and start killing people is like the worst low class violent mob behavior that these law and order Republicans decry when they see it in their own communities or on their own televisions, and then they're advocating it on an international scale.
There was a candidate, I don't know if it was, I think it might have been Cruz actually, but probably more than one, who said something along the lines of, I don't really want to have a man as president that I'd have to block my children's ears around, you know, who's going to use foul language and be uncivilized, and we don't want that. And I've heard that from a number of conservatives. We can't have this, you know, a president I'd have to shield from my children. But for heaven's sake, okay, again, think about this. In the same way that for the left, it's worse for somebody to make an unguarded racial remark,
sure,
than it is to, you know, bomb some country for no good reason. Like, because that,
yes,
because they don't ever, ever advocate ruining somebody's career over the second one. But the first one, you'll never be heard from again. Well, same thing with the conservatives. It's worse for Trump to, you know, to boast about how well endowed he is than it is for George W. Bush to launch a war for no, absolutely no reason whatsoever that can be remotely justified, that led to untold human suffering. That's a model. Like, you don't want, I want to keep my kids from that. I'll keep my kids from that.
I think they're acting like spurned girlfriends, because here's how it is. You know, but when Trump is doing that, he is quite explicitly signaling that in a literal sense, he's not going to speak their language, right? When you're talking to someone who's a progressive, you have to, you know, use your language accordingly. You have to say, you know, differently abled. You can't say disabled. There's certain terms. And these are verbal cues people use to demonstrate that I'm part of the in-group and I'm part of the team and I know what's up, right? So when Trump is using foul language, which, you know, I have some many friends who are born again Christians, and this is one of their, coming from Brooklyn, this is one of their things where they're lying in the sand. Like, you know, these words are against God and terrible, and these other words are okay. And somehow they get to decide which words are which. And it's perfectly fair when you're hanging around people, you know, to respect their boundaries and to speak accordingly. So when Trump is refusing to do that and is speaking in his own kind of low class, in a sense, jargon, this is telling them, he's telling them, I don't care how you guys act. You're going to have to get aboard the Trump train or go away. So, of course, they feel repudiated and spurned. But I think he's making it a point to show he's swinging towards the general and making it a point to modern Americans that he's not going to kowtow to the religious right, which was for years a great tar and feather technique that the left used to say, you know, if you vote in President Romney next year, you're not going to be taught evolution in schools. Sorry, Bob Murphy.
Well, I keep saying we got to do an episode with the three of us. I'm not sure if that would work. I'm not sure if that would, I got to think about it. But anyway, we'll talk about that another time. Before I forget, this is hard to explain away, I think, for people who look to Trump as somebody, though, who is anti-establishment. He's going to shake things up. But if he's going to shake things up, how come Chris Christie is leading the transition team, and how come we're hearing that Newt Gingrich is at the top of his potential VP list? I mean, what is going on with that?
Well, he said explicitly that he's smart enough that if you've never had political experience and you're going to be the president, you need someone who knows how Washington works to kind of get your program through. I mean, he said this very, very explicitly. I mean, this was a big problem, I think, for Jimmy Carter at first, because he didn't really get along well with the congressional Democrats. And despite having big majorities, you know, there were a lot of issues there. So Trump's smart enough to be like, look, I can get elected, but I still don't know how the system works. You can only know how something works from the outside to a certain extent. It's going to be my opinion. It's going to be Rick Scott, who is the governor of Florida, because he's also an outsider. He has a lot of healthcare experience. He's endorsed Trump. I think it would be very, very dubious to have Gingrich on the ticket, because Gingrich is also known for his infidelity and coarseness, and he's also pretty much reviled in Washington, D.C. On the other hand, Gingrich really knows how to stick it to Hillary, so that might be a good thorn in her side. Maybe he'd name Gingrich as his like Secretary of State or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I have this sinking feeling that he would get elected on this wave of anti-establishment disgust, and then he'd surround himself with Council on Foreign Relations people for his foreign policy team, and it would just be same old people, except with a blustery guy.
Well, it has to be the same old. The pool's not that deep, and the point I always make to people is, if I had to bet money, I would bet President Trump would kind of govern like Schwarzenegger governed Florida, like California, or Michael Bloomberg governed New York. Like they, you know, he was just about management, but Trump doesn't have any strong, you know, he says very offensive things and acts in an offensive manner. But I read his book, Crippled America, right? It has no cognitive content whatsoever. It's things like, did you know this? Our tax system is broken and the dummies in Washington don't want to fix it. They don't have real leadership. So we need a real leader who's going to bring our tax problem under control. Next chapter, education. Hey, Tom, did you know it's a real mess? It's a disaster. And there's no leadership. And we need the leadership. This is literally the entire book. The only cognitive content in the book was him saying explicitly, I'm not going to touch Social Security. And he's also saying that he's going to raise taxes on the rich and cut budget deals. So when it comes to economics, he's really this kind of Bloomberg figure, moderate, you know, let's just cut a deal. And you know, I don't think he signed Grover Norquist's pledge to never raise taxes, because he's explicitly said he intends to raise taxes. And he's open to raising the minimum wage.
Yeah, that's another thing. And people are up in arms about that. Now, I am very unhappy about that. But we should remember—
You don't think there's benefits in raising the minimum wage?
Wait, hold that thought for a minute. Mitt Romney favored raising the minimum wage. So again, if you're going to be— I don't remember people absolutely going berserk when Mitt Romney has supported raising the minimum wage. So again, there's the same thing, that when Trump does it, it's like an unprecedented violation of liberty. But this is exactly the sort of stuff you tolerated from the other guy. You know, so, all right. So are you actually going to tell me there's a – tell me what the benefit to – the one benefit to raising the minimum wage would be, if I were a real misanthrope, I would say that envious people and ignorant people would then get what they deserve.
No. My argument for it, and I'm very sincere and I've been on this train for a long time, is I am sick and tired – of dealing with these Morlocks at the cashiers. Their only job is to introduce errors between my order and the inputting process. I want these people out of work. I want them to turn that screen around and I can input my order. When I go to CVS, I will wait online for that self-checkout. I do not want to interact with these people. So when the minimum wage is implemented, they'll all be out of work. They will not be cashiers or interacting with me, and my life will be significantly better.
Wow. All right,
and I'm not the only person I know who's an anarchist who feels this way. This is very much like, you know, we have to choose your poison. This is my poison.
Okay. I'm not sure I've had quite that experience, but I've seen on Facebook the line by line exchanges that you've had with various cashiers, and if that had been my experience,
oh my god,
yeah.
I'll give it to you in one sentence. Let's suppose the bill is $6, you know, what I owe them $6, and I'll hand them a $10 bill and a $1 bill, making 11, so they can give me back a 5. 100% of the time, they void their bowels because they don't understand what's going on. And it's like, you don't even have to think. Just put $11 into the machine and it will tell you to give me back a 5.
Yeah, I have done that too. And they confusedly try to hand you back the 1.
Yes.
No, I'm trying.
Yes.
First of all, I want to get a 5, and secondly, I'm letting you keep your 1s because I know. Yes. You need that for small change.
Yes, and it's at the point, like, if I go to a restaurant and it's like, let's suppose I get sushi and it comes with super salad and I don't want either of them, I'll still choose one and throw it out, because otherwise it's, I don't want either, but they're free, I don't want either. Are you sure? You know what? I don't need that argument. Just give me the salad and I'll throw it in the garbage because I don't want a discussion with you. I don't want to talk to you. My entire life has been structured about being able to not talk to people I don't want to. And this minimum wage will really help me out profoundly.
All right. This is a completely insane twist that the conversation has taken. I don't know what else to say. You have any predictions about how Trump versus Clinton would turn out?
I do. Just you wait until he's at the debate and he points to Bill Clinton in the audience and says, your husband is a rapist and you knew about it and you covered it up. And he's already started on that train. What possible response could she have to something like that? Here's something else I tweeted. Hillary likes to have these canned one-liners. She thinks she's very funny. She's very knowledgeable about, you know, intricacies of bills and things like that. You have to give her credit for that. She's not quick on her feet, and that's fine. Not everyone's quick on their feet. She's going to come in with her little smarmy smirk and have some kind of joke about Trump, and he's going to improv some devastating one-liner. And then when she's rocked on her heels, her instinct is always sarcasm and snideness. I was dead broke. If you listen to her interview with Terry Gross, and Terry Gross asked her why she changed her position in gay marriage, she explicitly said Terry Gross from NPR, who's clearly a closet Republican operative, she's like, no, Terry, you're accusing me of changing my position for political purposes, but obviously that's what she did. So as soon as Trump hits her back, she's not going to have a comeback on her feet, and she's going to look weak and pathetic. He's going to dare her to say, I dare you to say Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, and she'll either obey him and look weak or refuse and look cowardly. And this is the one. I'm predicting this one right now. If she has one of her coughing fits on stage, he is going to attack her rapid fire, and she's literally going to be unable to speak, and he's going to say things like, look, she's dying in front of us. Look, I like grandmas, but they should be in a home, not being president. She's weak. Oh. She's pathetic. And she's just going to be coughing the whole time. And he's like, let's take a break. She needs a breather. This woman is not well. That will be the moment that destroys her campaign. He's going to eat her alive in those debates. And as you know, most people in the middle don't care about ideology. They just respond like dogs to a visceral way towards strength. And I like the sound of this guy or this woman. And in those debates, he is going to have her in the palm of his hand. There's nothing she's going to be able to do.
Yeah, and this is where one of his clear weaknesses is going to be a strength. One of his weaknesses is he is weak on specifics, and he's light on his, you know, knowledge of the ins and outs of policy and the economy and all that stuff. He just doesn't know it. He's got some instincts, and that's about it.
Yep. And in 2012, Candy Crowley attacked Romney. She's the moderator. Remember, Candy Crowley and Obama both double-teamed Mitt Romney, and he stood there and took it, and Candy Crowley would prove to be wrong later about that, even though it was completely inappropriate. Can you imagine one of the moderators teaming up with Hillary against Trump? He would fillet them both and completely emasculate them both, which is hard to do with someone as manly as Hillary.
Yeah. Well, yeah, in this case, we also need to remember that people, you know, most people, when they watch a debate and they don't have very, very much invested on either side, they're moved by who seems to be in charge, who seems to be winning, who seems to be confident.
Except for our debate where people just felt bad for you.
Yeah. Oh, geez. I should have put a caveat in there. Yeah. But my goodness, it's funny that sympathy alone could have led to such a crushing and overwhelming victory on my part. Isn't that funny?
It's not funny because this is America and people have big hearts and small minds.
Yeah. That's our big problem. That's our big problem here in America. All right. So you think then that he's going to run away with it for these reasons. But on the other hand, look, the Clintons are dirty and vicious and, you know, they'll do anything to win. Aren't they going to dig stuff up? I mean, you don't even have to dig that deep. You dig 2 inches and find stuff about Trump.
Well, here's the other thing. I think, first of all, just like in 08 with Obama Clinton, it is much harder for him to have gotten the nomination than it would be for him to win the general, right? That was a major, major feat to take on 16 other Republicans with great resumes and to win in that divided field. That's, I think, going to be much harder on paper than to win the general. Just like for Obama, it was much harder to beat Clinton than it was to beat McCain, right? So that's a big one. Number two is, you know, their strategy is to keep calling him racist, and it's like the 10,000th iteration is not going to do it. You're going to have to hit him with something else, and he's so mercurial, it's very hard. And the polls already came out that he's tied with her in the swing states. Now, he hasn't even turned his guns on her yet. And now, the other brilliant thing about him is, wait until he starts hitting Clinton with all these past scandals, which they thought were dead and gone, and which Hillary's like, well, I don't want to talk about the past. Well, when Trump makes an insult, then objective journalists have no choice but to explain what these references are, right? When he says these crazy things, the reporters have to be like, well, what he's talking about is this. And thereby, all these old stories are revived and brought to the surface. You know, I made this prediction earlier, I think, on Kennedy. If he's willing to accuse Ted Cruz's father of being involved in JFK assassination, I am certain he's going to bring up the rumor that Webster Hubbell fathered Chelsea Clinton. And why wouldn't he? And then they have to start explaining that one.
Yeah, I'm sitting here just contemplating this. This is why, you know, what Lou Rockwell and I used to review the Republican presidential debates here on the show the day after. The debates with Trump and Clinton are going to be, it's not going to be, you know, these aren't going to be the Lincoln-Douglas debates, put it that way. It'll be very, very different, but they're going to make for darn good podcasting. I'm already salivating at the very prospect.
It's going to be a bloodbath. And here's the other point. You know, she is treated with such reverence by her cabal, right? Like, the Clintons are very known for their extreme secrecy and extreme loyalty, right? And that's fine. Can you imagine being the guy who has to pretend to be Trump when she has her debate prep? Can you imagine? They're not going to be willing to go as far in their debate prep as Trump is going to be willing to go on stage. If Huma's playing Trump in preparation, you think Huma's going to even in practice say, "Your husband's a rapist, I dare you to confront that"?
Yeah, right.
They're going to treat her with kid gloves, which is doing her an enormous disservice. But they have no other choice but to treat her with kid gloves because this is someone who you work with, you respect, you admire. You're not going to want to go there towards someone who, you know, you have on a pedestal.
Well, and not only that, but I mean, in the back of their minds, they have to know she's the ice queen.
Yes.
To people she considers to be even mildly her enemies.
Yes, and I forgot who it was, but some woman remember when they were president, some woman refused to testify against the Clintons. She was one of their inner circle, and she went to jail for them. So their loyalties run strong and it runs deep, and that loyalty is just going to manifest itself in pussyfooting around the horrible thing. And it's also hard to predict where he's going to come from. Listen, Ted Cruz could have prepared for debates for years. The idea that your dad shot JFK was going to come up, this is not a likely scenario that crossed anyone, and that is exactly what happened.
Exactly, exactly. All right, listen, I'm going to let you run here. When you write these columns, half the time I don't know about half the time, one-tenth of the time? I don't know. It's some percentage of them would make for a good podcast episode, probably every single one. I'm just giving you a hard time. But I shouldn't be too tough on you. I mean, I know you're still reeling from the debate loss, but I definitely want to get you on more often. I'm going to link to that column of yours, by the way, with the it really is a good headline. I mean, if somebody else had to write a headline for you, you could do a heck of a lot worse than that one. And a lot of people have done a lot worse than that one for my columns.
Oh, yes.
But tomwoods.com/659 is where you can find that column. And, of course, you can find out about Dear Reader, which I mentioned at the beginning. I've told you all about Michael Malice. What's the website for Dear Reader? I'll have it up.
KimJongIlBook.com.
That's pretty good. It's a pretty good one. Okay. All right. Well, thanks again, Michael. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. Let's talk about something a fellow Tom Woods Show listener is up to. It's a website called evolutionofeconomics.com. And the author of the site is a graduate student at Johns Hopkins University. And the site covers all kinds of topics. Just looking at the recent posts, covers Keynesianism and the evolution of economic thought on various topics, monopoly theory, free trade and protectionism, and a whole lot more. So it's worth checking out, as are all these sites that you hear started by Tom Woods Show listeners. Would a Tom Woods Show listener start a bad site? Is that even conceivable? So check out evolutionofeconomics.com, and remember that you can get a shout out for your not yet started blog or website, and get a bunch of free video tutorials to help you get up and running as an expert blogger in no time at all. Details on how to do all this can be found at tomwoods.com/publicity. And remember, don't forget, this is the big week. This is, as I'm talking to you today, it's, let's see, 9th, 10th, 11th. Today is the 12th. You're going to have to hurry up. The 12th of May, 2016, Ebates is giving away, cash rebates of 15%, 15% at 250-plus retailers. I use it all the time. I told you about the $40 I earned on some flowers. So you'd be crazy not to do this, especially this week. So check it out at tomwoods.com/ebates. Tomorrow, I am actually not sure what's coming up. It's going to be a mystery, which will make it all the more fun when you tune in. Thanks for listening. Oh, wait. I just remembered. Episode 657 was the episode about episodes. It was the one where I went back down memory lane of these past 2.5 years, and I looked back at episodes that I liked or episodes that people should have liked and for some reason they didn't download or whatever it was, and I forgot one. And so I want to point – and of course, I could say this about so many of them, right? The debate over the guaranteed income – the basic income guarantee, that the discussion I had with Matt Swilinski on that, I thought that was one of the better episodes as well, especially if you listen through all the way to the end. Listen through all the way to the end on that one. But the one I forgot is one that's going to seem a little obscure, and that's why I'm mentioning it, because it's easy to overlook this one. And that is episode 110. It's the episode with Steve Hogarth. Now, you may not know who Steve Hogarth is. He's a lead singer of a band called Marillion, which have had a rather dedicated following over the many, many years of their existence. They've had a bigger following in Europe than in North America, which has meant not as many tours in North America up till recently. But you may think, ah, yeah, but I don't even know Marillion. I don't know this crazy band. I can't trust Woods' taste in music anyway. But Hogarth is such an interesting person to listen to, and it's also an interesting story about a band that, as I say, in North America didn't have quite the reach that it had in Europe, and that figured out things like crowdsourcing early on. They figured out what a fan base can do online. Their fan base in North America demanded that they come tour there, and they realized that financially they couldn't make it work. So the fans just crowdsourced and raised some money, threw the money at them, and said, now come to North America. And these North American fans then went ahead and bought tickets too. Even though they donated, they then went ahead and bought tickets on top of that. And they did that for Marillion. I mean, that's how strongly people felt about them. And then Marillion crowdsourced the production of their Anarachnophobia album. They said, even before we make it, we want you to buy it. Would you consider buying it before we even record it? And many, many, many people did that, and that gave them the seed money they needed to go ahead and record it. So anyway, it's a great story, and he's funny, and he's got great sort of rock star stories to tell. So I recommend that one. And it's called The First Money Bomb, because it really was about the episode talked a little bit about how they raised money through the internet in the 1990s, and they realized, boy, this internet really is something. And they were the first British band, apparently, to have a full-blown website, because they saw the potential of the internet, of course. So, and I'm a Steve Hogarth fan, and I sang one of his songs to my she's now 2 years old, but my little Sarah, shortly after she was born. I had the Marillion song "Map of the World" in my head, which is a very straightforward song. It's not especially progressive song, but very straightforward. But it's a cute song. It's a sweet little song, and it has to do with somebody who, you know, kind of goes through the 9-to-5 grind, but who dreams of something more. And then one day she just finally says, "That's it. I'm going to go out and see everything." And I sang that to little Sarah. So anyway, so it was fun to talk to Steve Hogarth. And I had that conversation right around the time little Sarah was born. It was the same month, I think. Let's see. It was the same month that she was born. So check out episode 110. I left it out of the episode about episodes, and that was an injustice. All right, now I really am done. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.